And welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and at iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, July 8th, 2015. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Happy to be back. And my guests are novelists Emily St. John Mandel and Diana Wagman. First up is Emily St. John Mandel. Emily was born in British Columbia, Canada. She is the author of three previous novels, Last Night in Montreal, The Singer's Gun, and The Lola Quartet, all of which were Indie Next picks. She is a staff writer for The Millions, and her work has appeared in numerous anthologies, including The Best American Mystery Stories 2013 and Venice Noir. She lives in New York City with her husband, and she's here primarily to talk about Station 11, published by Vintage. Hi, Emily.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. I love the book. And
thank you.
I'd love to hear you talk about the genesis of Station 11, how it came about.
Sure, absolutely. So there were a couple of starting points for this book. As you alluded to in the introduction, I had a piece published in Venice Noir. And that was sort of the first genre in which I published novels. I was always writing these kind of literary books with a bit of a noir bent. So they tended to get categorized as literary noir or sometimes even as crime fiction, depending on the market. And it seemed to me, after three of those books, that if I were to keep on going in that direction indefinitely, that I might eventually be pigeonholed as a and for what crime writers do, but anything seemed kind of unappealing to me. You know, those marketing categories could be a little bit of a trap sometimes. So I thought, okay, for my fourth book, this is probably a good moment to try something completely different. I really love film and theater, and I was interested in writing about what it means to devote your life to your art, the costs and the joys of that. So I thought for my fourth book, it would just be a very kind of quiet meditation on the life of an actor. I was imagining it as a literary novel set in a modern-day traveling Shakespearean theater company, moving from town to town. But then at the same time, there was something that I've been wanting to write about for a while, and I've been thinking about the best way to approach it. And that's the sense of awe that I often feel at the world in which we find ourselves. You know, the incredible technological marvels that surround us, things we take for granted, like air travel, iPhones, electricity. So it occurred to me that an interesting way to write about those things, to consider our world more broadly, would be to write about their absence. So I thought, you know, what does it look like if I keep that idea of the traveling Shakespearean theater company, but set it in a landscape where the modern world has been stripped away? So that was really the genesis of it, you know, starting with the idea of the life of an actor and then eventually decided to set it in a post-apocalyptic landscape as a way of writing about the modern world.
How much did you know going in? I guess, in other words, are you a plotter or a pantser? And did you have plans for the ending? I mean, I love the ending. Without saying a word about it, as I was reading the book, I wondered how I would feel at the end of it, because of the post-apocalyptic landscape, because of what was going on. And I thought you just pulled it off wonderfully. Were you writing to that point?
Thank you, for starters. I'm glad that worked for you. I was not writing to that point until I was fairly far along in the book. You know, I guess I've always been a pantser. I fly by the seat of my pants when it comes to figuring out how a book's going to end, in particular. So I always just start writing and see what happens. You know, you write a scene and then another scene, and then that gives you ideas for a whole chapter and then eventually a whole section. And I've always written these very nonlinear structures, and I like the multiple points of view. So what I end up with is an unbelievably incoherent first draft, and then I figure out how it all goes together later. But there was a point, I guess, I was probably about 200 pages into the book, into the first draft of the book, where I did realize how I wanted to end it. And without giving away what the last seven words of the book are, I felt like from that point onward, the whole book was leading up to those last seven words.
Mm. Yeah, it was a wonderful way to end, and a few chapters actually before the actual ending was just a brilliant ray of hope for those readers who love to have hope in novels and wonder, probably as maybe they're beginning the book, how there could ever be hope.
Right. You know, it's an interesting thing. I feel like so much of the post-apocalyptic fiction I've encountered, both in books and in movies, you know, it's really been the post-apocalypse as horror novels. You know, it's so easy to go in that direction. And I really love a lot of those works. Like, I was fascinated by and very influenced by The Road, for example, by Cormac McCarthy, mm-hmm. which is pretty bleak. I mean, cannibalism, you know. Yeah, it didn't get much worse. It was important to me to not write The Road. You know, my feeling going into this book was that it's not that I don't think there would be a period of unbelievable mayhem and chaos and horror immediately following a societal collapse. And that's the ground that a lot of authors have tread in this genre. It's that it's not plausible to me that that period would last forever. You know, it seems to me that mayhem's not a really sustainable way of life over the long haul, over decades and generations. I think we'd eventually start to figure it out. So for that reason, a lot of the action, almost all of the action that takes place after the apocalyptic event, which in this book is, of course, a flu, takes place 15 and then 20 years after. Because I was more interested in writing about what comes next. Now, what's the new world and the new culture that begins to emerge after that initial period of chaos and horror?
If you just tuned in, I am talking with Emily St. John Mandel. Her novel is Station 11. Wonderful, wonderful fiction. Is there a character you especially relate to in this book?
Yeah, you know, I'd have to say Miranda. I think she was my favorite. And it's funny because people ask me that and tell them Miranda, and they all say, oh, yeah, me too. I don't know if it's Miranda's boring day job or her, I don't know. I don't know what it is. But people do seem to connect with her, and I certainly did too. You know, I have no plans for a sequel to Station 11, but I do imagine using some of those characters again in other multiple point of view, nonlinear works. And Miranda's the one I think about the most in that regard.
I want to go back and read your other novels now. Did any characters in this novel come from any of those?
One minor character. There's a woman named Dahlia who plays a fairly small role. So there's a major character named Clark who works for a management consulting firm. Mm-hmm. And he's conducting what's called a 360 review, which is something I used to do when I was an executive assistant with one of these companies. And it's an interesting process. A company will identify an executive who's in need of improvement. You know, say they're really good, but they yell at their staff or miss deadlines. And they'll go in and they'll interview everybody around that person, you know, subordinates, peers, boss, etc. And what they get is a very complete picture of this person, which they put together in a report and present to them. It's an interesting process. Yeah, so Dahlia is a very minor character. Who Clark encounters as part of this process. He interviews her. And she was also a fairly minor character in Singer's Gun, my second novel. Mm. And the protagonist of that book worked in the firm that Clark goes into, this fictional water consulting firm. So, yeah, I think that's the only holdover from other books.
Interesting. Yeah. It would be wonderful to hear you read. Could you read a few pages or a few minutes,
absolutely.
Actually?
Yeah.
Okay.
So my favorite section to read is chapter 6 of the book. It takes about 2 minutes.
Okay.
And this is from a moment in the book when the world is just starting to come undone. An incomplete list. No more diving into pools of chlorinated water lit green from below. No more ball games played out under floodlights. No more porch lights with moths fluttering on summer nights. No more trains running under the surface of cities on the dazzling power of the electric third rail. No more cities. No more films, except rarely, except with a generator drowning out half the dialogue. And only then for the first little while, until the fuel for the generators ran out, because automobile gas goes stale after 2 or 3 years. No more screens shining in the half-light as people raise their phones above the crowd to take photographs of concert stages. No more concert stages lit by candy-colored halogens. No more electronica, punk, electric guitars. No more pharmaceuticals. No more certainty of surviving a scratch on one's hand, a cut on a finger while chopping vegetables for dinner, a dog bite. No more flight. No more towns glimpsed from the sky through airplane windows, points of glimmering light. No more looking down from 30,000 feet and imagining the lives lit up by those lights at that moment. No more airplanes. No more requests to put your tray table in its upright and locked position. But no, this wasn't true. There were still airplanes here and there. They stood dormant on runways. They collected snow on their wings. In the cold months, they were ideal for food storage. In summer, the ones near orchards were filled with trays of fruit that dehydrated in the heat. Rust blossomed and streaked. No more countries, all borders unmanned. No more fire departments, no more police. No more road maintenance or garbage pickup. No more spacecraft rising up from Cape Canaveral, from the Baikonur Cosmodrome, from Vandenberg, Tanegashima, burning paths through the atmosphere into space. No more internet. No more social media. No more scrolling through litanies of dreams and nervous hopes and photographs of lunches, cries for help and expressions of contentment, and relationship status updates with heart icons whole or broken, plans to meet up later, pleas, complaints, desires, pictures of babies dressed as bears or peppers for Halloween. No more reading and commenting on the lives of others, and in so doing, feeling slightly less alone in the room. No more avatars.
Thank you very much. That was Emily St. John Mandel reading from Station 11. Here in Southern California, we've been mired in a severe drought, so it's not been hard to wonder about no more water flowing from faucets.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah.
But I did love that chapter, too, because it, among other things, it you know, and throughout your book, there are moments where, you know, I just stopped and was grateful for what we do have. And as you said, you know, I mean, here ending with, you know, no more social media, no more avatars. It's like,
right.
Well, wait, you know, as much as a pain in the behind it, that all can be, I think I'd miss it.
I might miss it. I don't know. That's the one thing in that chapter that I'm not completely sure about.
Well, speaking of social media, how much are you expected to do? As I mean, your book has been just so incredibly successful. Are you still expected by publishers to be active, or do they lay back on that?
I am still expected to be active, but a lot of my activity, you know, there are dates that were set up, in some cases almost a year ago, so before it was at all clear that the book would have any success whatsoever. So I just did my 77th event for Station 11.
Uh-huh.
So that chapter I just read, I think I may have inadvertently memorized it over the course of 77 events. Like, I'll often be reading it, and I'll think, I don't think I need to be looking at the page. But, you know, that's kind of a scary thing to test in front of a large audience. I've been very active with the book. And, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, that does take you away from the writing. Like, you know, those 77 events, that was not quite 77 flights to different cities, but close. You know, it's a lot of disruption to one's day-to-day life and certainly to one's writing. On the other hand, you know, as writers are always saying to each other when we're all burnt out and hanging out at literary festivals, the only thing worse than touring is not touring.
Yeah, sure.
It is such a privilege to have the opportunity to tour, and I'm aware of that at all times. So, yeah, it's been exhausting, but it's also been an extraordinary year.
Curious about religion. There's very little religion or spirituality in the lives of these characters pre or post-apocalypse, and those who are involved are wacko. And so I was wondering, just in terms of, you know, I started thinking about dystopian novels in general and then Station 11, and I was wondering if there can be no God or true spirituality or religion if the world melts down.
Great question. I don't know. you know, religion has never been a part of my life, personally. So it is an imaginative stretch for me to imagine a character with religious belief. I'm going to challenge slightly something you just said about them all being wacko, because there is a character named August who has seems to me to be a very kind of sincere and low-key spirituality. You know, he's a very gentle person who imposes his beliefs on no one, but it's important to him to say a prayer over the bodies of the dead whenever he encounters them, you know, kind of wishing them well as they go on to whatever comes next. So I tried to use him a little bit to balance, I would say, the two other religious people in the book who are kind of wackos. You know, there's Elizabeth, who thinks everything happens for a reason, or this happened because it was supposed to happen, which is frankly quite chilling, you know, as the worldview in the context of a worldwide pandemic, or really frankly in the context of history. You know, it's I've always found that idea quite disturbing, that, you know, by that logic, the Holocaust happened because it was part of a plan. You know, it's horrifying to think about. Yeah, and then the prophet is, of course, the major religious character. He is quite negative. He's really just exactly the figure that I would expect to naturally arise in a situation like this. It seems to me that any time we see a complete societal breakdown, any time we see conditions of poverty, not a lot of opportunity, that what we see in those cases are warlords and cults. You know, it's a kind of extremist religiosity can flourish very easily in that kind of setting. So I saw him as sort of the most inevitable character in the book. And I think that's why you see a lot of characters like him in post-apocalyptic fiction, is that in any circumstance where you have a traumatized population who's lost all structure very quickly, that those people would probably be somewhat vulnerable to somebody who seems to have the answers and who does provide, you know, some kind of structure, as warped and strange as it is sometimes.
Yeah, that's true. August was a wonderful character in that way. The prayers and there was such care in his being. And yeah, he was another.
Yeah, he was one of my favorites.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites too. In the revision process, earlier you said that, you know, you got the draft down and then you sort of dealt with structure and other things going in after the first draft. Is that how your first drafts go? Are you interested in covering the pages and getting to the end and then worrying about what you have and how it goes together? Can you talk a little bit about that in regards to Station 11?
Yeah, absolutely. I do think with the first draft, the most important thing is to just get something on the page, even if it's terrible. You know, it's supposed to be terrible. It's the first draft. It's kind of my feeling. So what I've ended up with all four novels, is a really pretty messy first draft. You know, it's nothing like what it ends up looking like in its final form. Station 11 was probably particularly messy because it was a more complex structure than I'd really tried before with my previous books. So, you know, I just kind of had this sort of muddle of chapters and sections moving back and forth in time and inconsistencies and confusing things. So I do a little bit of editing while I'm writing the first draft. You know, I just can't help it. Like, you see something bad and you have to try to fix it. But yeah, my goal is to just get something on the page. I find myself thinking about, this might sound a little strange, but when I was a kid growing up in Western Canada, we got two TV stations. One of them was CBC, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and I remember tuning into some absolutely random afternoon show about a guy who carved ducks out of blocks of wood. And they were really kind of striking, realistic-looking things. The interviewer said to him, "So, you know, how do you do it? When you have a block of wood, how do you carve a duck out of that?" And he said, "Well, you look at the block of wood and you carve away everything that isn't the duck." So I kind of see, I always think of that when I'm writing a book. You know, it's like with the first draft, you're creating the block of wood, and then you carve away everything that isn't the doc or isn't the book, to be more precise, in the revision process. So, yeah, messy first draft. And then the revisions themselves were endless. I read the book aloud. I revised it in random page order, which is a useful trick I came up with a few years ago. I reformatted it so it looked like a book on the page. I gave it to friends to read and revise from their notes. I think the version that I sent to my agent was labeled version 26, to give you some idea. So, yeah, it was pretty exhaustive.
How long did it take?
About 2.5 years altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Say a little more about revising in random page order. I love that idea.
Sure, absolutely. So I had kind of a lousy printer, and if you send more than 100 pages at a time to the printer, then it'll crash. So what I would find is, you know, I'd send the first 100 pages, and I'd be pulling them out of the printer, and then I'd start again, you know, page 101 to 202 or whatever. And what I would find is that when I pulled those pages out of the printer, you know, without having read what came before, I would notice all of these incredibly awkward sentences that I hadn't really seen. And my theory is that when you read a book consecutively, perhaps particularly a manuscript that you've been staring at for 2 years, you can't even really see it anymore, I think that your brain just knows what to expect and fills in the gaps and skips right over awkwardness that, you know, to the extent you don't really even see it anymore. Whereas if you revise, say, page 3, then page 250, then page 75, then page 14, and just skip all over the manuscript. And this, by the way, is really only at the phase where you worked out your major structural problems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're just looking at it in a sentence-by-sentence level. So if you revise in that random order, in my experience, you catch all kinds of things that I personally just don't see when I'm reading it through start to finish. So, yeah, it's a really useful trick. I also retyped the entire manuscript, which was, it's a little hard on your hands, but kind of the same thing. You notice all kinds of problems you didn't see before.
Mm, that's a great idea. Yeah, that just the imprinting of the order of the pages that, you know, you think you're reading it, even if you read it aloud, but somehow things go by.
Exactly. Yeah, you're somehow skimming, even so.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I heard you speak at Literary Orange back in April, and I remember that you said you were homeschooled, and I've been wondering how homeschooling affected your becoming a writer, or did it?
Yeah, I think it did. So I was homeschooled in Western Canada, and, you know, I always, it's kind of a strange thing at this point in time, because often I find in the United States, if you say you were homeschooled, that's often code for fundamentalist Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these kids are kept home, so they're not exposed to the theory of evolution or science or any of that stuff. My parents were just kind of hippies. They just wanted to try it, see how it worked. The schools in my area weren't that great. So, yeah, we tried it as an experiment for kindergarten, and then it worked out, so they kept me home until I was 15. It was a really uneven education, to be absolutely honest. I wish that I'd had more science and math. But what I did have was an enormous amount of time, which for a kid who loved to read was just heaven. So I read my way through every book I could possibly find. You know, we'd go to the library and come back with these stacks. So it was wonderful in a lot of ways. And there was a period of time when I was quite young when one of the requirements of the curriculum was that I had to write something every day. And I was by no means a writing prodigy. You know, these were silly little poems about daffodils and cats. but it was it established a habit, which is something that I'm tremendously grateful for. So I was in the habit of writing a little poem or a story every day from a very early age. And that was just something that I kept on doing long after the time when it was required of me. I loved to write, you know, as a kid and then as a teenager. And my first career was as a dancer, but I found even then that when I went for walks, I would have to bring paper and pens because otherwise I'd be writing on Starbucks napkins. So it was just, the homeschooling did influence me as a writer, both in terms of giving me almost unlimited time, and which meant the freedom to read all the books that I could consume, but then also starting me off as a writer.
Mm. Yeah, that's great. And what isn't great is that we are at the end of our time. I wonder if you have any words of advice for the writers listening or any advice you've received that has kind of stuck with you over the years.
Yeah, sure. So there are a couple of things that, ideas that I think are important. The first is that you have to finish things. You know, it's really easy to start a book or start a short story or start a poem, but it's way harder to finish them. And it's by forcing yourself to finish it and figure out the problems and work through them that I think you become a better writer. The other thing is, you know, don't assume that the publishing world is closed to you. I think there's a really damaging and and really completely false ideas that you have to know the right people or live in Brooklyn or go to the right parties or have an MFA. You absolutely don't. You know, the publishing industry is full of people whose only job is to find good work. So, you know, personally, my first agent pulled me out of a slush pile. I didn't know anybody going in. So, yeah, I think those are the two things that I come back to as useful pieces of advice.
That's great. Yeah, MFAs are the subject of much of our conversation on this show, and I'm happy to hear you say that.
Yeah, and I have friends who love their MFAs.
Sure.
But, you shouldn't feel like you need one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much for coming on Writers on Writing.
That's a pleasure.
Okay.
Great. Thanks.
That was Emily St. John Mandel. Her wonderful book is Station 11, and loved it. If you haven't read it, read it. Check it out of the library. Buy it. Something. Anyway, when we come back, we'll be with Diana Wagman. Her new novel is Life Number 6, so stay with us. Don't go anywhere, okay?
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. You see, man made the car to take us over the road. Man make the trains to carry the heavy load. Man makes the electric lights to take us out of the dark. Man made the boat for the water, like Noah made the ark. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. Now listen. Man thinks about little bitty baby girls and baby boys. Man makes them happy, 'cause man, he makes them toys. And after man has made everything he can, money to buy from other men. But this is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl. Lost in the world of a man. Oh yeah. And he's lost in bitterness. This is a man's world. Oh yeah. This is a man's world. Nothing without a woman. or a girl. This is a man's world. This is a man. This is a man's world. I know and you know this is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing, nothing without a woman or a girl.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I was here the first half of the hour with Emily St. John Mandel, author of Station 11, and I am back with Diana Wagman. She's the author of four novels and numerous short stories, essays, and reviews. Her second novel, Spontaneous, won the Penn USA West Award for Fiction. Her most recent novel, The Care and Feeding of Exotic Pets, was a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers selection and received rave reviews in the New York Times, LA Times, and Wall Street Journal, among other publications. She's here primarily to talk about her new novel, Life Number 6. And before I go on, let me say that she is going to be at the Pen on Fire Speaker Series next week. You can find out more by going to my website and click on Speaker Series, and the website is penonfire.com. Let me also say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests and not those of the University of California Regents. Hey, Diana.
Hi, Barbara. Thank you for having me.
Oh, sure. It's great to have you back. Talk about Life Number 6 and how this book came about.
Well, a student asked me, how long it took me to write this book, and I said, 35 years. Because 35 years ago, I actually signed up to be crew on a sailboat when I knew nothing about sailing, had never been on a boat before, don't know how to swim, and everything that could go wrong went wrong, and we had to be rescued by the Coast Guard. And I have been thinking about this story and thinking about making it into fiction for all this time, and was finally, you know, over my PTSD and inspired to do it.
Interesting. You know, a while back we emailed about the book, and I recall you saying something about that it began as a hybrid, sort of a, maybe there was more memoir in it.
Yes.
And that it evolved in time. Will you talk about that?
Sure. You know, my agent thought it would make a good memoir. I thought it would make a good memoir, but as I wrote it, I thought, you know, there's just not enough conclusion here. There was no great epiphany. I was stupid to get on the boat, and I was stupid at the end of it, you know. And I think memoirs need to have an arc. But then I thought, but there's something so fascinating about who this young girl was, I was, when I left, and why would I have done this? And so I thought I would write it sort of like a tale for the time being, and Ruth Ozeki novel that I really liked, where it's her name and her husband and what's going on in her life, and sort of a hybrid, a novel and memoir. And that's what I tried to do, but I found myself so bogged down in the truth and unable to sort of create drama and create a compelling story. And I kept stepping away from it and stepping away from it. And I also was not very kind to that 19-year-old me when I did this sort of hybrid draft. I was angry, you know, that I had been such a passive go-along kind of girl. And so I had to create a new character of Fiona, who's not like me at all, who's much spunkier. And, you know, yes, she gets into this situation, but I was able to look at her with love.
I was curious about that, because it does seem that when writers base fiction on something that happened to them, that there is that sense, or that very real experience, actually, of getting bogged down with the truth and breaking away from the truth can be monumental.
Yes. I had to make Fiona tall, blonde, you know, physically incredibly different from me, just as a starting point, so I could sort of imagine her in a different way. I had a couple pictures up on the wall in my office of, you know, just actresses that might sort of be like her, just to see them and think of that person instead. And there were actually six of us on the boat, and two women, me and another woman, and the other woman had been hired to be the cook, and she was Dutch, and I had her in there, and I did away with her. I sort of combined Fiona with her. Fiona was hired to be the cook, and I did that so that she would be sort of the only woman. And once I did that, and once I made her physically different, gave her a little bit different past growing up than mine, it was much easier to go forward with the book.
Mm. I am talking with Diana Wagman. Her new novel is Life Number 6. I am about a third of the way into the book, and I am loving it. And,
oh, thank you.
Yeah, I'm really enjoying this, and I am also marveling at your structure. You have a one point of view character, Fiona, and she is, you know, there are chapters of her then and now.
Right.
Talk about structure. And why you chose that and how you chose that and all of that?
Well, what was interesting to me about this story, the more I decided to fictionalize it, was not the boat story. That's just an adventure story that, you know, people survive or they don't. But the who that character would be 30 years later. And then I thought, you know, how to combine these stories. The very, very early draft was all boat, and then we fast forward to all the present day. And, you know, it was clunky, and the present day was not as interesting. You know, the boat goes very fast because there's a hurricane and things are happening. And so I realized they had to be integrated. But I worked really hard to structure it so that the action doesn't stop dead when you come to the present day, because in the present day, she's dealing with an out-of-work husband and, you know, some conflicts in her life and this desire to see this old boyfriend that she went on the boat with and her own medical diagnosis, her own cancer. And it's, I didn't want it to just stop dead. You know, we have this horrible storm going on, and then we get to the present day and nothing is happening, you know, except people sitting around talking. So I worked really hard to build that structure so that both stories sort of move along and get faster and arc.
Hmm. You know, you talked about just now about getting back to the present day and not having the action stop, and I was remembering that you've been a screenwriter, and wonder how that experience informs your fiction writing.
Oh, you know, so much. I was not an English major in college. I never got an MFA. I read a lot, but I'm not trained to be a fiction writer. But I am trained. I went to the AFI. I am trained as a screenwriter, even though I never had any real success at it. So
you have had a movie produced.
I did have a movie produced. Of course, when I saw it, not one word of it was still mine. But, you know,
well,
I did have that, and it went straight to video and et cetera. But anyway, I can't help but think in that sort of traditional three-act structure, what does the character want? Give them a goal. Give them obstacles to that goal. it's just sort of built into me, that kind of storytelling. So I think it really makes a big difference in how I write, even though I consciously try to ignore it. I think, oh, I shouldn't do that, you know. I should be more internal and more thoughtful. But, yes, they end up, the books do end up page-turners. At least that's what everybody tells me. And I think it's just the screenwriting influence.
That's one thing I love about your writing, is that they are page-turners and that there isn't too much internal. That there, it seems to be, at least for me, there's just enough.
Oh, thanks.
And I love how you just sort of take the reader along with the action of the story, which brings me to my request to hear you read. I'd love to hear you read from the book.
Well, I'll just read the first page and a half or so, a little bit. I'll just read it. It is never quiet on a boat. Riding in a car can be silent as you travel down the highway with the windows up and the night sky outside. Huddled inside a small tent in a spring snowstorm, the snowflakes make no noise as they fall on the blue nylon. Even on a fold-out couch in an apartment in New York City, the world can be hushed, everything outside so unimportant it seems mute. But boats are never quiet because they are never still. They rock and jiggle and complain. The wood creaks, the lines vibrate and hum, the water licks and laps and swallows. Even at night, the small flags, the sails and bits of canvas flap and snap. It is incessant, a constant sloshing and sighing of desire. I want to go. Let me go. I sat on a bench in front of my favorite statue of Venus. Her marble skin, her empty gaze comforted me. The news from my doctor had been bad. Dr. Carolyn had left a message on my cell phone, which wasn't very professional, but then she'd been my OBGYN for a long time. I had cancer. Cancer. Just the word is ugly. Two hard syllables, the hissing C in the middle. I was glad I worked as an educator at the Getty Villa. Glad I could turn to ancient, immutable beauty. This statue, the Mazarin Venus, Roman, circa AD 100, had not changed for 2,000 years. Her eyes were in eternal, serene contemplation. She was beyond life or death. Cancer didn't matter to her. The hand that had formed her, the very world she was created into, all gone. Now she stood among humans with cell phones taking digital photos, protected by a laser beam alarm. She didn't weep or protest. She wasn't smiling. She didn't care. Is that enough?
Keep going.
Okay. The lights clicked on automatically, and I looked out through the door of the gallery. The sky had turned a gray of smudged charcoal, and darker clouds were rolling in. Rain was coming, always a surprise in Southern California. Beyond the sycamore trees, I could see a black line of ocean, the sea always there, covering most of the planet. I turned my back to it. I'd been in L.A. for 24 years, and all that time I pretended it was a desert community. I ignored the beach, the docks, the watery life. Even the occasional rain seemed an affront. It was October 27th, 2009, almost exactly 30 years since I went to sea in a brand new 52-foot sailboat, sailed into a storm and should have died. Five of us, the owner and his hired crew, left Newport, Rhode Island on that cloudy November morning, bound for Bermuda. The storm became a hurricane, and many things went wrong. In the years since, I can say I have capsized, floundered, and run aground. But those are only metaphors for the darker periods in my life. I have never been on another boat.
That's great. Thank you so much. That was Diana Wagman reading from Life Number 6. I love this. Anyway, I'm curious. I ran into a friend of yours last night, Dan Dooling, at Festival of the Arts. He's the scriptwriter, has been the scriptwriter there for years and years, and Pageant of the Masters, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought you up. I don't know. We were talking about agents, and he's like, well, my friend Diana Wagman, and she, you know, he started talking about you and agents and how your process for finding an agent. And he thought it was just a marvelous process.
Oh, and I said,
oh, I have to ask her about that. See if she'll talk about it.
A lot of people ask me about it. well, I can't, geez, I have had three agents. Well, actually four, but one didn't last very long before he went off to med school. I think he was 12. Okay, maybe he was 22. And when we signed, I said, oh, maybe I should send him a bottle of champagne. And my husband said, maybe you should send him some juice boxes. And very shortly thereafter, he called me and said, I'm leaving the business to go to med school. It's what my mother always wanted me to do.
Oh, gosh.
So I should have known, because his Facebook picture was him playing air guitar. So I should have known that it wasn't meant to be. But after that, I had gone through all my friends' agents and tried, and I had Karen Feeding, my last book, in manuscript, and I felt pretty good about it. And so I went to something called QueryTracker.net.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, looked at tons of agents, looked at their websites, and then I made it like a job, sort of. I sent three query letters a day, sometimes two. I'd just pick people, and I'd look them up, and I'd try to see who their other clients were. And I had a really good query letter with just a little blurb of the book, and I sent it to 57 agents. And I remember these numbers so well. Out of the 57, 22 asked to read the first three chapters or 50 pages or something. Out of those 22, 11 asked to read the whole thing. Out of those 11, two offered to sign me. And one of them's in New York, and the other one was here in Los Angeles. So I met with him, and he was also very young but very nice, and he was at a big agency and pretty new to the business, and I asked him who his other clients were, and he was very excited. He had just signed Dog the Bounty Hunter. I thought, okay, you know, probably he's going to make Dog a whole lot of money, but I just don't think we're on the same wavelength. And so without meeting Tara, I went with the other woman. We liked the same books. We had a lot of things to talk about. And she's in New York, and it wasn't until well after my book was published that we met, actually, in person.
So how long did that take?
A year, almost.
Mm-hmm.
A year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 9 months. And I think, and I have friends who have had, you know, two agents turn them down and they give up. It's harder almost to get an agent than it is to get a publisher, at least to read it.
Right.
You know, 'cause they're all about making money.
Yeah.
So you just have to persevere and find someone who responds to the material.
Well, I know people, too, who approach a few agents, and if they say no, that's it. And we writers forget that it's a business.
Yeah.
And in business, and you learn this in sales, which I've never taken a sales course or anything, and I hate sales, really. But in sales, you have to hit, like, what, 100? You have to make 100
right.
cold calls to get even 5% to respond at all.
Right. Right, right.
And we forget that with writing.
Yes, because it's art. To us, it's art, but to them, it's business.
Yeah.
And you're lucky if they also see the art in it. But, you know, these days particularly, my husband gave me a statistic. There are 45,000 works of fiction published every year.
Mm.
And so the idea that anybody gets any recognition
right.
is amazing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah, it is amazing. Anyway, well, that's, I love that story. I'm going to remember it and tell it. And I may get you to tell it next week at the speaker series when you're down here. back to life number six. So then I'm always curious about revision. Do you revise along the way? Do you get a first draft down on the paper and then you start fiddling? How do you work, and how did you especially work with life number six?
Well, I had the good fortune to go to Gentel, which is a writer's retreat in Wyoming. Very beautiful, and it was really, I applied and I got in and it was great. And I had 1 month there, and I decided I was going to get a draft done no matter what. And I sort of had the bits and pieces, and I had, the boat story was all written down pretty much, but the rest of it was not. And so I just wrote forward. I didn't allow myself to go back because I wanted to come away from there with a draft. I find it's easier to rewrite from a full draft than to rewrite along the way. So I did that. But in that, you know, in the part I read, she's diagnosed with cancer on that first page. And in the old draft, cancer doesn't come in until much later. But when I got home and I read it all the way through, I thought, you know, cancer is such a good impetus for this whole journey she has to go back and see this old boyfriend and try to relive this boat. You know, I did have cancer, and I think that's one reason why I wrote this story now, 35 years later, because having cancer was much like being on that boat. I was out of control. I was, you know, I felt sort of lost. I felt like I couldn't do what I wanted to do. I had to, you know, just put one foot in front of the other and hope I would survive. It was very similar sort of feelings. So I thought, oh, well, then I can use that as her through story, you know, for the present day. So that was a huge rewrite. And the first draft was, you know, close to 500 pages. So I cut quite a bit as I went through, you know, the present day story was very repetitive, and it wasn't until I had this whole draft done that I sort of had to go back and push Fiona to be a really different person than me.
So. Well, I'm loving it. And,
thank you.
And I will be sure to finish before I see you next Tuesday. I can't wait for you to be down here with Seth. Before we go, though, since we're at the end of our time, any advice that has stuck with you over the years that perhaps another writer or mentor has given you?
Well, much like getting an agent, the best advice I got was in film school, actually, at the AFI, when my screenwriting teacher said to the whole class, you know, persevere. He said, the people who just keep doing it eventually will succeed. You know, it may not be the big success you wanted, but you will have something out there that you're proud of. I think, particularly with writing, unlike other art forms, my daughter's a musician and she practices, you know, scales and et cetera. Unlike that, or painting where you learn to draw, writers think they can just sit down and do it. And I think you really need to practice, and you really need to put in the hours and keep at it, and your first book may not sell, and your first short story may not sell, and your third, fourth may not sell, but if you keep at it, you will get better and better. That's what I think.
Good advice. And I'm going to let you go now.
Thank you.
Look forward to seeing you next week.
I can't wait.
Thanks so much for coming on the show, Diana.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. That was Diana Wagman. Her book is Life Number Six, another one you should read. You should go to the library. You should buy it. You should do something. You should come to the speaker series next week and see her and Seth. More about that at penonfire.com. I'm going to leave you now. And you've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. Stay tuned for Sister Rue and Come back next week. Either Nicole or Marie will be here with more marvelous writers. Stay in the chair.